The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Erica Janik, and I'm here with Ben Henry. What have you got for us, Ben?
We do this thing here at the show where we ask people about the stories behind their personalized license plates. And we do that because you never know. Sometimes it's just a license plate. Other times it's their whole life boiled down to six letters. You've got this tiny space to say something about yourself. What do you do with that space? And that's what our story is about today. One license plate and the story it tells about the lives of two women. So I guess I'll maybe just ask you to introduce yourself, if you don't mind.
Sure, I'm Wendy Curry from Ware, New Hampshire. I'm a software engineer for Dell.
Can you tell me what your license plate says?
Sure, my license plate says Jazz Mom.
Jazz Mom. Her daughter's name is Jasmine.
This is my first vanity plate. I never could think of something that would be something I'd want on a plate, but it makes me smile whenever I see it.
License plates are a peculiar form of communication because most of the people who see it are sitting behind you in traffic or walking by in a parking lot. They can only guess at what it means. To a passerby, Wendy's license plate is maybe cute and forgettable, but for Wendy,
if I have a plate, every day I pick her up, it says her name on it, then she's gonna know that that's the most thing I'm proud of in my whole life, and that's absolutely true.
The license plate is sort of a promise from Wendy to Jasmine and to herself. I spoke to Wendy at her home, tucked away in the woods. She and her husband, Brian, have three cats and three dogs.
Brian's the cat person, I'm the dog person.
They moved to New Hampshire for Wendy to start her first job out of college.
Did you want kids?
Yeah, so we decided it was time, we were settled, and I think I went off the pill when we got married, so it was probably 5 years thinking, wow, by now, odds are something should have happened. The longer we went where I wasn't pregnant, we figured something was up. So we went to a specialist where in Boston. Because we were college students, there was no insurance. He said, you got to forget about it because it's going to cost you more to do tests than not. So we kind of did and focused on our careers. And then I think in the same year, I got my first symptoms of multiple sclerosis, right? So it was like, okay, well, that's a higher priority than figuring out whether we can have kids. And if we can't have kids, then there's a reason for it. So we just sort of moved on.
Was it hard to just not know?
It comes and goes, right? So some days I would obsess about it.
Other days it felt like she was living a full life and she had come to terms with not being a mom. Wendy has an aunt who she's close to. She went to visit her aunt one day. They were researching their family tree at a cemetery of all places.
Well, it was raining, so we were whining about going out in the rain, and she just said, so what are you up to these days? And I went, I don't know. I think probably we're going to get around to that adoption thing. And before the words were out of my mouth, she said, do you want a little girl?
Things were going to change really quickly. Wendy's life was going to collide with that of another person. Tina Bruches.
Yeah. You just basically ask me and I'll answer. I don't know what to say.
Yeah. Okay, well, why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is Tina Bruches. I was born in Plattsburgh Air Force Base, New York, so I'm considered an Air Force brat.
Tina had moved to the East Coast from California to escape an abusive relationship.
My kids probably remember me as being an angry person because I put up with it because I was afraid to leave. And then he had me convinced this was all my fault. And I'm not saying I'm innocent. I'm not perfect. Yeah, he had me convinced that I deserved what he did to me. And I believed it.
Tina had grown up in an abusive home and struggled off and on with alcohol and drug addiction. She'd sought treatment in California to help her stop drinking. When she finally got out of that bad relationship, she got a call from her mom telling her that her husband had served her with a restraining order. It meant she couldn't see her three sons. Out here on the East Coast, Tina was starting over. Back in California, she had started going to church.
So you would go at night to
we'd
church.
We'd go to the morning as a family, yeah. And then I'd go again at night, yeah. Just for me because...
And what did that time mean for you, I guess?
It was probably the best time of my life. That was the closest I've ever been with, you know, to God. I mean, I just didn't want to drink and do drugs anymore. I just felt the love there. I mean, unconditional love. You know, I went there, they'd say, come as you are. When I started that church, I went in there on crystal meth, all high all the time, and they accepted me for who I was.
During all the chaos of leaving her husband, Tina's addictive behavior had resurfaced. Out here, she lived in a house with several others who had substance misuse disorders, and that was making it hard to address her own addiction. Also, during this time, Tina had a daughter. After years of not speaking with her sons, not seeing them, having a daughter felt like a second chance. To be a mom, to finally raise a kid the way she knew she could.
Well, yeah, because first of all, it was my last chance. And second of all...
What made you feel that this was your last chance?
My only daughter. And we had a different type of bond than the boys, you know, mother and daughter. You know, I've never had a girl. I've been raised around all boys. It was just different because we had a, you know, I'd sit down every day and do her hair and do girly things with her, do her paint her nails, you know, just that type of bond. And I used to sit down and read with her every night, and we would pray and sing and stuff like that. You know, she had her own bed, but she wanted to sleep with me. I'm like, get in your bed. Next thing I know, right back on me. I coddled all my kids too much. And we used to sing songs all the time about the Lord. And you know, so I started her out the right way as far as God goes. You know what I mean? It's just that the drinking I could have done without.
Tina knew she was a good mom, but she also knew her house was not a good environment, not with her housemates drinking. Eventually, Massachusetts Department of Children and Families, the DCF, they noticed.
They said, we don't like that environment for her. You need to move. And I couldn't afford to. So I felt trapped.
After a court case, the state took custody of Tina's daughter.
The drinking addiction is very powerful, and I can see that. You know, and I talked to the people in group settings that do the same thing. Drink and drug, and they lose their kids, and then they got to fight for them back.
Tina's daughter's name is Jasmine. This is where Wendy comes in. She's part of Tina's extended family, but she isn't in touch with most of them, so she didn't know Tina. She didn't know her story until that rainy day at the cemetery with her aunt.
She said, do you want a little girl? Now, the reality is it's not her. She doesn't have permission to just give me this kid, right? She's in foster care and it's all complicated, but I went, that sounds great.
The family wanted Wendy to adopt Jasmine. Wendy and Bruce had talked about adoption before, but the process is long and daunting. To Wendy, it was worth it.
So my mom has borderline personality, so she's got all the challenges with that. So when I was 22, I stopped trying to rescue her. And when I did that, the rest of the family was like, if you don't care for your mom, then you're dead to us. So whatever, that happened about the time that we found out we couldn't have kids, right? So because of that, in my personality, I said, that's okay. I built my own family, I built my own community, and we were fine. I think because a part of me always, always wanted to be a mom, to do better than my mom, and to have, to complete our family. But all those negative things in my head, why you can't be good enough, and would stop me from doing that. And as soon as I saw this connection, and it was a person that my family loves, that it was, I just can't imagine not doing it.
In the long run now, and through all these years, I see that she couldn't have gotten a better place to live. everything they do for her. I mean, she's got the life that I could never give her.
For Wendy, adopting Jasmine was a way to open up that door that had always been closed to her. She was a mom now. And the way she chose to say that to herself and to Jasmine and to everyone was with a license plate that says Jazz Mom.
Even though the snow has started to fall and we've traded in our rakes for our snow shovels, there's still a lot of leaves around. And we got a question from NHPR's own Ellen Grimm about what actually happens to those leaves we carefully piled along the curb.
My question is, where do all the leaves go? Because we all spend an awful lot of time raking up a lot of leaves, putting them in bags, and setting them out in front of our homes, and then they disappear. And I just wanted to know where they go.
To get to the bottom of it, we sent producer Hannah McCarthy out to investigate.
However you get rid of your leaves, grass, sticks, and branches, they're all eventually going to end up in the same place, a state of decomposition. But let's start in Manchester, where Ellen lives.
Yard waste collection in Manchester began back in 1993. It actually had been collected previously, but as part of people's trash.
This is Mark Gomez, the guy in charge of environmental programs in the city of Manchester. He says that in 1992, the state passed a law that prohibited the disposal of yard waste in landfills. The primary reason was to save limited space in New Hampshire's dumps for actual garbage. But
There has been another benefit to it, in that when yard waste decomposes under anaerobic conditions, like in a landfill, it produces methane gas. And for those concerned about greenhouse gas effects, methane traps about 30 times the amount of heat as carbon dioxide.
But if you take that yard waste out of the mix and put it somewhere else, you can avoid that methane production. So where is it going instead? Well, it starts with Bruce.
Bruce Allen Pacey Jr., truck driver for Pennard.
Bruce works for the independent company contracted to collect yard waste in Manchester. He pilots the collection truck that drives around the city all day.
Yeah, we put in more than 8 hours regularly.
Bruce does garbage collection, too.
I don't know. I might not have popular opinion, but I personally prefer trash. I don't know why. I can't really put my finger on it.
Bruce and I sat in the cab while his coworkers, Jake and Tom, jumped on and off, grabbing bags and flinging them into the truck.
Missed two bags in the opening to that
murder. Yeah, we're going back out. Okay. All right. I totally saw them.
Manchester will take a lot off of your hands. Leaves, garden trimmings, branches, and stumps if you cut them to size and bundle them. But Bruce says that there are some things that will gum up the operation.
In the yard waste, no plastic bags is a big one. It doesn't biodegrade, I guess. Anything that's not, you know, leaves, dirt, anything you'd find on the ground in your backyard.
Assuming your leaves and branches do make it into the truck, though, where do they go next?
If you get on 101 East,
yep.
Exit 5, Raymond Chester,
okay.
Take a left,
okay.
Go straight for like 3 or 4 miles, and it's a right dump road, I believe it is,
okay.
Dump road.
Yep.
And there'll be a big sign that says Chester Transfer Station.
I'm Lee Brown. We are in Chester at the compost facility.
You may have actually seen one of these places before. Maybe you've noticed it on the side of the road and weren't sure what you were looking at. Row after row of giant piles of dark soil. These used to be your leaves. And in Chester, they're taken care of by Remy and Sons.
We put them in a pile. We cover them with some compost that's already been here cooking for a while to hold all the bags and everything tight in place so it ain't blowing around. And as the year goes on, we flip the piles, constantly flip them. The more you flip them, the quicker they break down.
We climb into Lee's front end loader and rumble past piles that look less and less like dirt and more like bags of leaves. Lee digs the truck's massive scoop into a decomposing pile and steam rises into the air.
There's a bacteria. I don't know if I'd call it bacteria, but it's what breaks down all these leaves.
Okay.
And it has to stay, like I said, a temperature between 120 and 140 in these piles to keep them cooking.
There's actually a lot going on in this compost pile. Bugs and earthworms and fungi and anaerobic bacteria breaking down disparate paper bags full of fall leftovers and turning them into a commodity.
See right here? Finished product. After all of it's said and done, see how it's still a little warm there? She's still cooking, but it's done. I mean, if you look at it by spring, the stuff here, beautiful.
This whole process can take a year or more, with Lee turning the piles over 5 or 6 times per year. But with the bacteria doing most of the work, overhead is minimal.
Just me and the machine. Me, the machine, and fuel. That's it.
Once the process is done, Bruce says, the compost is sold to landscaping companies for around $16 a yard. So thanks to the process of decomposition, your leaves eventually turn to gold. It's just not your town's gold. In Manchester, the city pays Pinard Waste, and then Pinard pays the people who compost the yard waste. Mark Gomez with the City of Manchester says this is the one catch to saving all of that landfill space. It's arguably better for the environment, but it's not cheaper for taxpayers.
The downside is that obviously there's a cost to collecting yard waste separately. And when you run the numbers, the additional hit to the City of Manchester budget is about $750,000 per year.
Of course, if you do want to do a little alchemy of your own, you can always try composting in your own backyard. But a word to the wise, make sure you shake up that pile every once in a while.
If it sits and rots, it will get a pungent smell and then people will complain.
What does it smell like?
You want me to take you down and then you can try to explain it?
No, that's okay.
It's pretty nasty sometimes, but like I said.
Even though many people rake their leaves, we've also heard that raking leaves isn't necessary. So why do we do it, Hannah?
A lot of people think that leaves will smother a yard over the winter, but it turns out that some leaf cover is actually good for your lawn. It fertilizes your grass and builds soil.
So we're never raking again.
Well, there is one caveat. You shouldn't leave your lawn totally covered, especially if there's a chance that a leaf layer could be under a bed of snow all winter, which in New Hampshire is pretty likely, because this can cause something called snow mold, which is this pink or gray fungal disease that attacks your grass and leaves you with spots all over your lawn.
Yikes, now I'm not sure what to do.
Well, I pulled our very own Sam Evans Brown on this one because he knows a thing or two about the environment. And he says you can just shred all those leaves up with a lawnmower and get the best of both worlds. And of course, he also suggested composting.
Thanks, Hannah, and thanks to Sam. But that's not the last we're going to hear from Sam. Up next is a story from Outside In that explores a possible New Hampshire first and the squishy art of myth making.
Right, we got a campfire. Sweet.
Where's my beer? I need my beer.
This is the sound of a gathering I hosted in my backyard. We had crackers, cheese, beers.
Don't forget the kumquats.
Producer Taylor Quimby brought kumquats.
They're so good.
I feel like I should have a poker.
The purpose of the gathering was for Taylor to tell us a story. And he wanted an audience, or a peanut gallery, if you will, who you'll be hearing throughout.
Okay, I'm Annie Ropeek. I'm a reporter at NHPR.
This is Lauren Chulgen. I'm also a reporter at NHPR.
I'm Robert Garoba, and I contributed the batteries.
You'll also hear Outside In producer Justine Paradise, who was wielding the microphones. And this is how the story began.
So, Sam, I wanted to start by asking you a question, which is, do you know the story of Pheidippides?
Pheidippides?
Pheidippides.
With an F.
With a PH, actually.
Not a real thing.
Okay, no, this is a real, this is a story, and it takes place in
490 BC, during the Greco-Persian Wars. 150,000 Persian soldiers have landed at the Bay of Marathon in Greece. 10,000 Athenians march out to meet them. Incredibly, the Athenians defeat the Persians against those terrible odds. It's an epic battle that's been written about in all the ancient histories. And afterwards, the Athenians send their legendary runner Pheidippides back home to let everybody know what happened. It's about 25 miles back to Athens, so Pheidippides, who just fought a horde of Persian soldiers, by the way, runs full tilt in all of his armor all the way through the mountains back to Athens. Then he bursts into the city and says, "Victory! We have won!" And then he collapses and dies. And that is the story of the first marathon. So I guess I had heard that story, but just not the crazy name. Now, the reason I told everybody this story, Sam, is because I love a good parable. You know, they're entertaining, of course, but they also teach us about ourselves. In this case, the story of the first marathon is this allegorical tale about endurance and about the human capacity, I think, to push past limits and achieve something that nobody thought possible. The thing is, most sports are so old that we either don't know their origins at all, or they're sort of shrouded in myth and mystery. But it just so happens, Sam, and I'm very excited to tell you, that I have discovered a sports origin story that took place not far from where we're standing right now. It's a sport pretty much everybody's heard of, but you have not heard this tale, and I think it has the makings of a timeless legend.
A timeless legend, like something that happened in ancient Greece, but it happened in New Hampshire.
Yes.
A New Hampshire legend.
Yes, we are the ancient Greece of New England. Just bear with me here.
I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Pull up a chair, throw some wood on the fire pit, and sit back, because Taylor is going to do some myth-making. You decide just how timeless it really is.
All right. So, this story begins in the 1970s, and it's a story about
two men, two dueling philosophies, and an argument.
He's just one of the most competitive people I've ever known. He's a jock.
Charles is sort of a workout freak. I love working out, too. I was running in Central Park.
On one side was author, bodybuilder, and all-around outdoorsman Charles Gaines.
I love to fish and hunt and canoe.
He's got a rugged Robert Redford look, and is best known as the author of Pumping Iron. That's the book and subsequent documentary that made Arnold Schwarzenegger a household name.
The greatest feeling you can get in a gym, or the most satisfying feeling you can get in the gym, is the pump.
On the other side of the argument was Hayes Knoll, a New York stockbroker and former college football star.
76 years old, born in 1941.
Charles and Hayes were best friends and constant rivals. They played tennis, fished, and skied. A friend later joked that the pair could bet over the length of a dog or the number of bricks in a fireplace.
You have to do everything possible to win, you know, no matter what.
One summer in the late 70s, the two of them rented a house in Martha's Vineyard with their wives. And one night, while grilling bluefish and downing gin and tonics, they picked up on a long-standing argument about the nature of survival. It was a third beer debate that had been raging for some time now, and it had to do with who was better suited to survive in the wilderness, in a predator-prey sort of situation. Hayes thought his experiences in the high-stakes arena of the New York Stock Exchange made him an ideal survivor.
102 men for 100 days home!
He thrived on adrenaline and was unafraid to take risks.
The skills that it takes to survive are transportable across all environments, whether it's outdoors, indoors, stock exchange.
In other words, you could take that same survival instinct that you practiced in New York and you could move it to the tundra of Alaska or the savannas of Kenya and make out just as well.
I can survive in any jungle. So I can survive in the Wall Street jungle, I can survive in any jungle.
The idea that the New York Stock Exchange prepares you to hunt a wildebeest in Africa is insane.
Well, I know whose side you would be on then. You would be on the side of the bodybuilder who said, that's crazy.
There's a great song by Hank Williams Jr. called A Country Boy Will Survive. We know about rifles and shadows and how to find moss on a tree and how to make a fire when you don't have any matches. It's just the idea that you could take city skills and transfer them into that sort of environment is typical of the kind of hubris that a lot of my city friends have.
The two drank and argued into the night, but because it was something of a hypothetical pissing contest, there was never any way to take it further than words. That was until a few weeks later, when a friend sent Charles a catalog
featuring a very unique piece of equipment.
It was a single-shot CO2 cartridge-powered pistol that shot paint-based pellets.
It was the Nelspot 007, the world's first paintball gun. It had actually been invented more than a decade earlier for use by foresters to mark trees on difficult terrain and farmers to mark bred livestock. Charles was living in New Hampshire at the time, writing and teaching at New England College in Henniker. He ordered a couple of pistols, then invited Hayes up to see his new toys.
And I said, we're going to settle this one way or another. You say you can survive in the woods in New Hampshire as well as I can. We'll see about that, big boy. Come on up here.
But first, they had to test the equipment.
So we did an old-fashioned duel. We wrapped towels around our waist. And
we took paces, turned around, and fired. And I missed him, and he hit me right in the butt.
And he leapt a little bit.
But we sort of knew this was something we could use.
The guns were slow and not particularly accurate.
Occasionally, the pellets would would blow up in the barrel.
But they would do.
Charles had a little field. It was all brushy. And I said, why don't we go out and hunt each other in this field?
I knew where he was almost the whole time from the get-go. And I came up behind him. He was sitting down, getting his breath behind a tree. And I didn't have the heart to shoot him, so I just put the gun up to his head and said, okay, who wins, right?
Why are men so insane? I'm so sorry. This whole time I've just been thinking, like, men.
The paintball patriarchy.
I can tell.
And I didn't have the heart to shoot him, so I just put the gun up to his head and said, okay, who wins?
Now this is what you'd expect in a parable, right? The prideful and obviously wrong city slicker loses out to the woodsy folklore of the country boy. But of course, if this is an allegory, the lesson has to be repeated if you want it to stick. In Hayes' mind, the stockbroker, nothing was really settled. There hadn't been any rules. Charles was playing on his own property. It really ought to be best 3 out of 5. You get the idea. By this time, a third friend had joined the debate, a local ski shop manager named Bob Guernsey.
Guernsey is another tremendously competitive man.
And over the next few months, the three of them started to plan a grand experiment. A 12-person game that combined paintball guns and capture the flag and would span across 100 acres of New Hampshire forest. They called it the survival game. They came up with the rules, arranged for referees, and finally sent out invitations to friends who were just as competitive, just as successful, and just as crazy as they were.
We had a guy who was the best turkey hunter in the state of Alabama. We had a wild elk hunter, Green Beret lieutenant. We had a venture capitalist from New York. We had a surgeon. We had a movie producer.
On the side of the city slickers was Joe Drinan, a stockbroker and amateur boxer.
It was friendly competition, but believe me, it was fierce competition. I mean, except for me. I went in it not really knowing why I was going in it, to tell you the truth.
On the side of the country boys was Richie White, a licensed forester who still has his Nelspot 007.
So this tube on the top would hold the balls, so you'd load that right up with the balls.
And Charles wasn't the only writer in the group either. In fact, there were three of them, including a staff writer for Sports Illustrated.
I mean, a lot of these guys brought their wives. Some of them brought their children. We must have had a total of 50 people.
People like Joe's wife, Anne.
I looked at this equipment and I thought, I don't believe this. It's like a bunch of 5-year-olds going out in the woods and just having fun.
It was going to be a spectacle, but it was also going to be very organized. Along with the invitations, Charles and company had sent along 8 pages of rules. The players would be spread out around the perimeter of some 100 acres of land. Each one would be equipped with a pair of goggles,
one of the Nelspot pistols,
a few handfuls of pellets,
I think it was 12 or maybe 20 pellets,
a compass,
and a map.
Inside the forest would be 4 flag stations. Nothing flashy, just 12 colored flags hanging from a branch.
White, green, blue, and red. And the point was to get one of each of the flags from each of the flag stations and be the first one out at the exit point, which was also marked on the map.
Players, of course, could eliminate each other at any point using the pistols, but
to be shot, to be officially put out of the game, you had to have paint on your clothes.
Extremely Hunger Games.
You know what I'm thinking, though, is the Triwizard Tournament.
Or like that.
That's what I've been thinking this whole time.
But I was thinking like Clue, like the Green Beret, the venture capitalist, Miss Scarlet. Yeah.
The night before the game was scheduled to take place, everybody gathered at a local restaurant. The bodybuilder had rented out a private dining room.
We had toasts and wagers.
Oh, yes, there was the Calcutta the night before.
That's right.
Everybody bet on different people.
I mean, that's what everyone was bragging about, how they're going to win and why they're going to win.
People were shouting across the room, debating the same argument about survival skills that had spawned the game in the first place.
And of course, everybody had their own opinion on it.
In spite of his own argument, the stockbroker was a shrewd investor. He put his money on the Green Beret.
That he had been a long-range reconnaissance patrol leader in Vietnam. In my opinion, that was going to put him as the number one seed.
And then the floor trader, or the stock floor trader, come back and say, hey, you've never been in the pits trading stocks. You don't know what pressure's all about. I'll show you, kind of thing.
The forester was maybe the least braggadocious of the group. The surgeon was a wild card. The amateur boxing stockbroker was banking on a strategy of patience, he said. And the Alabama turkey hunter had openly abandoned the contest in favor of a more singular mission.
He said, Gaines, I have one ambition in this game, and that's to put your ass out.
Eventually, the night came to an end. Everybody went back to motels and couches and backyard tents and fell into a deep slumber. And the next morning, on June 27th, 1981, the 12 contestants assembled in the bodybuilder's backyard.
You know, there's a camouflage going on the faces. They've got the clothing. They've got the, you know, some people are talking, some people are not. And I'm going, whoa, this is pretty competitive.
They drove out into the woods of Henniker, where a friend and impartial judge had mapped out the 100 acres where they'd be playing. It was a hot, sunny morning, but inside the forest, it was dark and dappled and perfect for paintball. At 10 a.m., the referees placed the contestants around the edge of the forest, out of sight from one another, and at the sound of a bullhorn, the game began.
You have to do everything possible to win, you know, no matter what.
It became every little twig that snapped, or every little bird, everything, every breeze, every branch, it was maybe somebody going, and it was just what kept the thing so exciting.
According to the Sports Illustrated article that came out months later, the amateur boxer slash stockbroker was the first one out of the game.
I think it said that you lost your compass, or you lost your map, or you...
I don't know, I lost my way.
You lost one of the two.
The other stockbroker, the one that started the argument with the bodybuilder, he planned to outrun his opponents.
My strategy was, I thought, a great strategy. I was in great shape.
He knew the guns weren't very accurate, so he thought he'd sprint to each flag station, grab the flag, then sprint back out to the perimeter.
Then the entire time I would have to run around the whole thing, but I would never have to worry about being shot by anybody on one side.
Run in, grab, run out, repeat.
I think this is a good strategy. I like this guy.
It's not a bad strategy.
Didn't like him before.
No, but is it the same stockbroker?
Yes.
Same one.
Oh, no. I was going to say, I'm still on the Hunger Games, and I think that's a rookie mistake. I just think that you're walking into a trap if you go straight for the flags.
Run in, grab, run out, repeat. Meanwhile, the forester, Richie, he took the tried and true still hunting approach that he used when stalking deer.
Doing that, you hear someone else before they hear you, unless it's another person doing the same process.
How people played the game reflected who they were.
Every little twig that snapped.
Do everything possible to win. You know, no matter what.
The yellow flag station was tucked into a valley, bisected by a small brook. Blood Alley, they called it later, because of the carnage that happened there. A short distance away, the Sports Illustrated writer crouched silently. He fired a shot at the ski instructor, who had no idea he was there, but missed. The movie producer shot the deer hunter slash realtor. The trauma surgeon shot the Sports Illustrated writer. The bodybuilder hadn't seen anyone yet. He got one flag.
I didn't see anybody.
Two flags.
I didn't hear anybody.
But then ran into the top-seeded combatant in the group.
He had been a long-range reconnaissance patrol leader in Vietnam.
The Green Beret. They both fired and missed, then ran for cover. The Green Beret taking shelter in an old solitary shed that was propped up among the trees like a witch's lair.
We were shooting each other. I was shooting at him through the window. He was shooting me out the window. I was trying to circle around behind. And all of a sudden, I see this thing coming through the air, and it lands right at my feet and hits a potato. And Tony says, grenade!
Where did the potato come from? Why was there a potato?
It was a joke, of course, and the two, after some time, decided to walk away in a truce But the commotion had attracted another enemy, the Alabama turkey hunter.
He shot me, and the pellet didn't break.
The bodybuilder was still paint-free, and he had his nemesis dead to rights. But then the turkey hunter reached into a pocket, pulled out a paintball, and burst it with his thumb. He reached forward and marked the bodybuilder on the chest, who was standing there in shock. They were both out.
So that was my Waterloo.
Throughout all the struggle, the trauma surgeon had been earning the nickname the Death Doctor. He took Hayes, our sprinting stockbroker, out of the game, and four other people, and later said the experience was incredibly cathartic.
That is so dark. That's crazy.
Very concerned about this man.
As a trauma surgeon, isn't this someone who probably, presumably, has dealt with many gunshot wounds in his life?
You would think, but maybe that's, he's just on the other side of this. Maybe it's, it feels good. I don't know.
And meanwhile, Richie, the forester, quietly made his way through the woods.
Ghosted through the whole field, picked up all four flags.
I don't think he even fired anything the whole game.
I can't say that Richie White didn't take risks. He just avoided confrontation.
Do you remember when you got out with the flags? Did you know what had happened?
No, because it was over 2 hours. You know, I just said, well, who's ahead? I mean, who won? And they said, well, no one else is out. Clearly, the woods skills were the prevailing skills, you know, in the game.
Again, the parable delivers its message, but this time it feels stronger. Because it wasn't Charles, the bodybuilder, the Renaissance man, who bested his friend. It was a real country boy, a quiet, competent forester that showed everybody up. But my favorite thing about this parable, and about most sports parables, I think, is that it's infinitely repeatable. It's not enough to simply hear the story and know the outcome. You have to prove it for yourself. Only you get to be the country boy, or the city slicker, or the trauma surgeon, or the forester. You get to play and see if the lesson still sticks. And imagine yourself as part of the legend.
So that's the story of football.
That was cool too.
But legends like the first marathon have the benefit of being ancient history. The first game of paintball happened less than 40 years ago, and the myth-making process is a little squishy.
There's something that I kind of want to go back to the Pheidippides conversation and just ask a rhetorical question of the group, which is, does it matter if the story of, for example, the first marathon is true? Do the details and their authenticity matter?
I don't think so.
I would prefer if it was true. Is this story all bullshit? Did you just make this up?
Well,
does it matter if he did?
I want to know, would that change your opinion of this allegorical tale of the first game of paintball if I told you that some of what I just said is a version of a story?
Yes.
You would feel betrayed if that was true.
I would feel betrayed.
When we come back, myth makers often have an agenda. And you actually pointed back to the very beginning to the story of Pheidippides, which you also indicated may not be true.
That is correct, that it is not true. So the first account of Pheidippides was written by Herodotus, who's kind of the famous historian who wrote all about the Greco-Persian Wars. And he wrote this about 40, 50 years after this battle at Marathon between Athens and Persia. And he told a completely different story about Pheidippides the runner being sent to Sparta, which was 150 miles away, in order to enlist their help for the war. They weren't going to join the fight because they have the tradition that says that they won't fight until the full moon. So no go. And he runs back to Athens. And it's kind of an anticlimactic story. You know, it doesn't have the same myth-making legend.
Much more running, though.
Much more running. I mean, it's super impressive from that standpoint. But a very different story and much more of a history. Now, 400 years later, there's another historian named Plutarch who writes this tale about a runner who runs after the battle, goes to Athens, and then falls down dead. But he has a completely different name. And then a third writer some years later, like another century after this,
writes this sort of combined story where a character named Philippides is now the one who runs back to Athens and falls down dead. But all the historians say that that whole story didn't happen. And in fact, the entire Athenian army marched back to Athens immediately after the battle.
Sounds like historians back in ancient Greece weren't really historians very much. They were just sort of people who wrote things on paper.
Well, they made it epic. I think the god Pan shows up in the Herodotus tale. So, I mean, I don't know how much you can take it at its word.
So, can we bring this back to paintball?
Oh, yeah. Let's do that.
I want to know first, whose version of the story did you just tell us?
So the version of the story I just told you was my favorite version of the story. And it came from the bodybuilder, who was a novelist and a storyteller, and he told the best story out of all the people I talked to. We're far enough away now that like a lot of people just don't remember certain details. And I think from a journalistic standpoint, some of those, you know, that happens. We're talking about things that happened decades ago, and that's okay. Then there's other things where there are small discrepancies, and that can happen too, and you can just acknowledge that that happened. And then there are bigger discrepancies that I don't quite know what to do with. I know which version of the story I like best, and that's the one I just told you. So let's talk about some of the problems. On the very minor scale, is it a potato or is it an onion that was thrown as the grenade?
That's going to bother me.
And either way, what was it doing in the dilapidated shack? We may never know.
The bodybuilder, he said it was a potato.
It's a potato. And Tony says, grenade!
There was a written account that was written by the Green Beret himself, not long after the game, who says it was an onion. The test where they did the duel.
I missed him and he hit me right in the butt.
They both told me that story, word for word, exactly the same. But in one of the written accounts that I read, they tested the gun on the bodybuilder's teenage son, Shelby, instead. Which I can see why maybe they changed.
It is true that like if something is too word for word, that's like pretty suspicious. They're both saying the exact same thing.
It stung a little bit.
It stings, but it's not that bad. It's like a bee sting.
Charles Gaines, the bodybuilder, told me that he was the first to win the stalking test in his backyard where they walked through the tall grass and he slowly came up on him and he put the gun to the back of his head and he didn't even have to fire. He just said, you're done.
It was a pretty simple, straightforward test, which I won.
The stockbroker, he told me the exact same story, but he won. It was the exact same story.
What?
And the truth is, my version is a true version.
His memory about losing is not all that great.
Yeah.
History is written by the victors, right?
Yeah, the hare beat the tortoise.
One of those guys knows the other is a damn liar.
Well, they're both in their 70s. Yeah, they're both in their
Do you think that they both believe their version of the story?
They both laughed about it to me. They both had a good laugh.
If there are any irreconcilable differences in his story and mine, call me back.
And there was a part of me that wondered if they're having a laugh at my expense. There was a part of me that wondered when I started to capture some of these discrepancies, whether or not whole sections of this story are fabricated for the purpose of telling a great story. Which is hard because I cannot deny that it is a great story.
Yeah, but it's kind of annoying because we came all this way and we had all these feelings. And then now you're like, no, just kidding.
Have you played the survival game? It's awesome.
A lot of the discrepancies I found come down to a central problem with the bodybuilder's narrative. He is a great storyteller. Just looking to tell a great story.
We had no idea it was going to take off, let alone make us any money, and we didn't do it for that reason.
But when you dig into the history of this legend, it's clear that there was an alternate motive, that there was a reason this story had to be so good, and Hayes in particular wasn't in it just to spin a good yarn.
What's his name, the other guy?
Hayes.
He was the one, didn't he take it to the next level?
Yes, he made a business out of
it. He was looking at this at a very different angle, and I remember that.
We were going to do something with this. I mean, you know, we were going to make something out of it, start a company.
Survival Game, an adult version of Capture the Flag. Two equal teams that begin at opposite ends of a playing field.
I should say, there is no question as to whether or not the game actually took place. The parable narrative is fuzzy, but a lot of the facts are crystal clear. And that's partially because you've got multiple first-hand accounts. Stories about the first annual survival game were published in Sports Illustrated, Outside Magazine, and Sports Afield.
which is exactly what Charles, the bodybuilder, Hayes, the stockbroker, and Bob Guernsey, the ski guy, needed in order to start their company, which they called the National Survival Game, or NSG.
I took it on the Today Show, the Good Morning America Show, the Phil Donahue Show, on and on and on.
They sold starter kits by mail, a cardboard box with a gun, pellets, a compass, and directions on how to play. They set up their first paintball field in New London, New Hampshire, and they started franchising fields across the country and overseas. They even landed an exclusive deal with Nelson Paints so that they could monopolize the market on paintball guns.
I want to say we sold 10,000 guns in the first year.
Hayes Knoll had put up $20,000 to start the business. Within 6 months, he'd made his investment back. Charles, who was never much interested in the business side of things, was the first to back out. He sold his share of the company back to Hayes and Guernsey for something in the six figures.
I was just tired of it. I wanted to get on to something else.
And not long after, things started to take a turn. The first competing businesses started popping up. A man in Texas sued NSG after allegedly shooting his eye out. After that, more lawsuits started to roll in.
And you don't even know whether they're injured or not injured. I mean, you know, it's really, it became a nightmare. That part of it became a nightmare. I don't think that's the only reason, but it put a real canker in the company.
And there were other reasons. Competition for pistols and fields, problems with the oil-based paints that the paintballs used. Paintball was taking off, but NSG, the company that launched it all, wasn't in the cockpit.
We just fell behind in the technology race, way behind.
Hayes was next to get out of the business. He sold off his share to Bob Guernsey, who kept it going as long as he could. But in 1995, he filed for bankruptcy.
I never spoke to him after that.
NSG had been sued more than 100 times in less than 15 years. Bob died a few years ago, so I wasn't able to get his side of the story. But from what I can tell, he never forgave the other two for how things wound up. Paintball has changed a lot since the 1980s. An arms race for faster, more powerful paintball guns took the sport out of the woods and into a different urban setting. Small fields with lots of little obstacles, shorter times, and tactical teams that don't need to know anything about moss or shadows or topography. It's a setting where the stockbrokers might actually have an advantage after all. They say that history is written by the winner. But when it comes to myths like this one, what if winners and losers have less to do with it than we thought? What if history is written by the people who come later? The storytellers who decide which details make for a better fireside tale? Or the marketing guy who writes the About Us page on the company website? If you read the paintball websites and forums, Bob Guernsey, the ski instructor, he gets a lot of the credit for the first game. If you read the sports magazines, it's Charles and Hayes. Either way, this history, it's still being worked out.
Well, so I guess my question is, so if we're still at the moment where we decide whether this becomes a myth or not, what should the story be? You know, what is the lesson that we should draw from the first game of paintball?
I think there might be something to, like, you know, every time you remember something, you're getting more distant from the event itself. Like whenever you look at a photograph, you're remembering the photograph more than you are the actual event.
Like, I think a lot about, like, how we'll write the history books about, like, this time in history, or like the time that we experience, like what that will look like in the textbooks of the future or whatever. And like all of, like, you used the phrase myth making, you know, it's just a way of understanding our own lives and our connections to the past and to each other. But I do feel let down by, I do feel like capitalism has corrupted your story somewhat. And, you know, I liked it when it was, and I do still like the element of it that is a sort of natural myth, you yeah. know?
If you look at the marathon model, which is not obviously a good model for what this is, but it took 500 years before the very false but much more entertaining story about the marathon guy running to Athens and then falling down dead. It took 500 years before that got put on the record. And if you think about 50 years have passed, okay, we're still in this messy phase, 450 years from now, what story will be told? And my guess is it will be a very neat, very lovely myth that isn't entirely true.
Today's show was produced by me, Erica Janik, with Ben Henry, Hannah McCarthy, Taylor Quimby, and Sam Evans Brown. Our staff includes Jimmy Gutierrez and Justine Paradise.
If you have a license plate that means something to you, or if you just have a question, seriously, any question about New Hampshire, about the way things are or the way things aren't, email me. I'll try to answer it. wordofmouth@nhpr.org.
Music from Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, Silent Partner, and Breakmaster Cylinder. Special thanks to Steve Davidson and Elizabeth Muzzy. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.